This is DreamWords. Tom Corvin by Paul Storey.
Chapter 33. Lochranza, small, beautiful, sitting quietly at the top of the island. To Tom's right, in the east and hidden by a small grassy mountain, the sleepy sea held Cregan's coast and Ayrshire's apart. Directly in front, as he descended a small track, water spilled inland to a tiny loch marking Arran's northeast corner. The main part of the village lay to its left, a straggle of houses strung out on the far side of the road as it bordered the loch. Stumbling on an isolated house, the boy wasted precious minutes battering on the door. He yelled through the letterbox and eyed the telephone sitting on a three-legged table with frustration. He briefly considered breaking in, but only minutes from Lochranza proper, he reluctantly ran on. When at last his feet slapped on tarmac, Tom paused and bent double, his hands flat on his thighs, breathing hard. The road ran left to the village and straight on to skip the right of the loch to a dead end. A quiet line of houses overlooked the tranquil water. In another time, Tom might have found the setting idyllic. There was nothing familiar about the place. The tiny hamlet was close, but the line of houses ahead closer. He straightened up, drew a breath, and as he steeled himself to run again, a noisy, clattering beat hacked the quiet dawn behind him to shreds. He whirled in fright to face the intruder. A helicopter, yellow, swept fast and low through the glen. It roared to his left, the words, Royal Air Force Rescue, stenciled on its hide, its nose tilted forward as though sniffing the earth. Kneeling at a large square opening, a crewman studied the ground as the machine flared up close to the near edge of the village. The engine thundered, grass and trees shook, and the Sea King paused before settling slowly onto a clearing by the road. Beyond the chopper, a small castle, a quiet icon of Scottish heritage, overlooked the busy scene. Two machines built for war doing time on community service. As the winchman talked the pilot down, Tom noticed a number of vehicles clustered nearby. Land Rovers and cars. And people too. Men and women with rucksacks. Police in uniform. Tom changed his mind, turned left and skirted the top of the loch. At the main road, he turned right and ran towards the gathering. No one paid attention to the boy entering the arena. The chopper blades had stopped, drooped, tired and silent. Two crew members poked around a hanging panel, and the other, the pilot Tom assumed, dressed in a one-piece olive-green uniform with cloth wings on his chest, talked to a policeman. A group of rescuers, radio aerials protruding from heavy rucksacks, hunched around the bonnet of a Land Rover inspecting a map spread on its blue-grey surface. Beside them, a magnetic whiteboard stood against the windscreen of another vehicle. Two photographs topped a list of radio call signs and names. They stopped Tom dead. Minutes before, when he'd first seen what was obviously a rescue operation, the boy had silently thanked his luck. Stumbling so quickly on the people sent to find Catriann and their father was more than he could have hoped for. The chopper could be at Cregan in 10 minutes and the hospital soon after. But now he looked at the images in confusion. He stared and stared at them. Two pictures. Two people. And although neither were what he expected, he knew them both. They had been scanned from originals, computer enhanced to remove scratches, isolate each subject. Despite their apparent ancient origins, the figures were instantly recognisable. He stood, wide-eyed, beside the men briefing over the Land Rover's bonnet. The pictures had been old, very old, but the likeness was remarkable, even in sepia tones. A faded yellow wash, jaundiced skin, and severe stares indicated that the models had sat long enough, thank you. He moved closer, bumping lightly against a man listening to the huddled brief. The leader addressed his men with short, crisp sentences. "They're likely to be confused. They might even resist your help." The voice trailed away, and the rescuer he'd bumped against glanced casually over his shoulder at Tom. Tom floated onwards until he stood by the second vehicle. He reached over and took the photographs from the board, one in each hand. As he stared at the photo of himself, the man he'd brushed against took a glance at his own copy cupped in the palm of his hand. He looked from it to the boy and back again. He spoke softly, interrupting the team leader's talk.
"Donald, I think we need another plan."
"What?"
came the indignant reply. But an instant later, all eyes were on the boy standing no more than 10 feet from the collective and confused centre. Tom was unaware of the attention building around him. He was preoccupied by the second image. There she was, in glorious sepia, her red hair hidden by low-tech photography. The girl in his vision. The girl in a moment of madness he thought might have been his sister from another time. Tessa.
Chapter 34.
Tom sat facing the open square of the chopper. The winchman checked his lap strap, gave him 2 yellow pieces of foam the size of pencil erasers, and mimed plugging his ears. Tom nodded and squashed the buds home until the deafening noise was muffled. Still, the machine shook him to his bones. The surreal isolation enclosed him like a dream. The world of the ordinary he'd just entered felt so strange. The muted fury of the blade scything the air in a never-ending circle, the smell of engine exhaust, the shimmering view, bright and square and filled with strangers, and everything bathed in knowledge that somewhere out there his sister was as alive or dead as Schrodinger's cat. Beside him, from the canvas seat to his right, Chief Inspector David Howard turned and gave Tom the thumbs up. They sat with their backs to the fuselage on the Sea King's port side. Tom tried to smile but was too full of anticipation and worry to succeed. The engine screamed, grass and heather shook, rescuers outside dropped to one knee and averted their eyes in homage to the noisy sky monster. The ground and the people fell away, slid sideways beyond the opening, and disappeared out of sight. Tom's excitement bubbled and he squirmed in his seat. He told Howard about Catriona and her father. But no, he did not know where Tessa was. He urged speed, impressed on him that Callum could die. The debrief was painfully slow and Tom was annoyed at the way the man had isolated him in a police van and talked to him alone and quiet as though he were a fragile child. At last, something seemed to twig inside the officer's mind, and he led them to the helicopter. Now they were on their way. Outside, the scenery slid sideways. The lock disappeared, and the hill he descended took its place. He saw in the thin line running up the slope every step of his journey. But the pain of his run was replaced by an emotion he'd not expected, and he blushed. In a few minutes, he would see Catriona again. He would descend from the sky outside the cottage, and she would be standing there, her long black hair flailing wildly in the downdraft. He would smile gently, and they would load her father onto the aircraft, and somehow, he didn't yet know how, he would find a way to be close to her and know her better. They moved fast, and within seconds broke beyond the point he knew would take them directly to Cregan. They passed it by in a blink, and with each second, Tom braced himself for the dramatic handbrake turn that would swing them up and over the green summit. But it never came. Tom yelled to the winchman's back, silhouetted as it was against the bright, vibrating world outside.
"Over there!"
he screamed, pointing to the tail end of the cabin. The inspector took the boy's hand and gently lowered it to his lap. He turned in his seat and placed his lips an inch from Tom's ear.
"Don't worry, Tom. They'll be fine."
This only made things worse. How could they be fine? The helicopter was the quickest way to get help to them. They could be landing in 30 seconds. He should be on his way to see Katriana again. Instead, they snuffled the ground fast and low towards the south of the island. At his back, through a small window in the side of the aircraft, Tom saw with aching and twisted neck muscles mountains of rock turn the bright dawn grey. Tearing at the buckle on his lap, he freed himself and lunged towards the open door. He grabbed the winchman to get his attention, and he succeeded. Even through the earplugs, over and above the muted cacophony of the bone shaker, he heard the man yell in fright. Safely cabled to the aircraft, the shock of contact spun him in one explosive instant to confront Tom. The man grabbed him and pinned his arms to his side. He was gentle but strong. He pushed him back to his seat.
"It's okay, Tom. You're safe. We're taking you home."
The winchman screamed this in his ear. But with the furious noise, the isolating plugs and the insane vibration, Tom did not take in what he'd said at first.
"You've gone past them!"
The boy's throat rasped as though his words were edged with roughened stone. The policeman at his side patted his head and said something like,
"There, there, don't be frightened."
And it was then that the crewman's use of the word home sunk into Tom's frazzled brain. He slumped in his seat, and Howard cupped a hand over Tom's. He leaned over as the winchman returned to his duties by the open door.
"Look, we're here."
They were over a forest, but Tom did not know what he was supposed to be looking at. All he could think of was Katriana and how he had let her down. A subtle depression snaked through the trees. It wound inland, away from the ring road and the sea. A private road, obscured by overlapping branches, burrowed through the forest. And then he saw what they were headed for. 2 miles on, the trees cleared to circle a green manicured lawn. At its centre was an enormous, majestic baronial building that some would call a house, and others, fixated by the crenellated walls, a fortress. It was as grey as a castle, as magnificent as a palace. The inspector squeezed Tom's hand and said something he couldn't hear. The aircraft circled the house and then dropped gently to the lawn directly in centre front. Given the nod from the winchman, Howard unlatched himself and then the boy. He had to tug on Tom to get him to move. Tom drifted to the opening and vaulted onto the strange new world that was supposed to be home. When they cleared the blades, the chopper lifted from the grey granite backdrop of the building, blasting their backs and whipping their hair into a frenzy of storm-lashed fronds. It disappeared exactly 58 minutes after he'd first seen the thing thunder down the glen. Together, man and boy, they watched the departing helicopter. Tom waited for it to bank left, to retrace the route they'd taken to get to this spot. But once more, it ignored his will to budge. To his horror, it kept on straight until it was nothing but a strange memory in his already warped mind. Inspector Howard said something incoherent. The man tapped him on the shoulder and Tom remembered then to remove the plugs. Turning to the house, he saw a single figure, a man standing at the top junction of two curved sets of steps that mirrored each other like the edges of grey petals.
"Come on, lad," the inspector said.
Tom ignored him.
"Why isn't the helicopter going to Creggan?"
The man was momentarily distracted as though the question had caught him off guard. But then he smiled like a politician and said, "We already had a police launch checking the cottage. They picked your friends up. They're going to be fine." Tom was disappointed and elated all at once. He'd missed the chance of seeing Katriana's face when he arrived with help. But at least he kept his word and brought them to safety. He just wished the policeman had explained earlier. Putting his arm around his shoulder, Howard walked his catch towards the house. Tom shivered as the policeman said, "You're home at last, lad. Home and safe." DreamWorks.com.